Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 287th episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast, which is brought to you by Lifetime. Lifetime's groundbreaking documentary series, Surviving R. Kelly, captivated audiences and sparked global conversation. For the first time ever, survivors and people from R. Kelly's inner circle shared their full story. Lifetime thanks the survivors for coming forward. Surviving R. Kelly, for your Emmy consideration. I'm the host of Awards Chatter, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is a strikingly beautiful and enormously talented actress, best known for her work on TV. Over the past 20 years, she has appeared on series such as ABC's I'm With Her, NBC's Whitney, and TNT's Franklin and Bash. But she is best known and primed to land her first Emmy nomination for her portrayal of Kim Wexler, a lawyer who has a complicated relationship with Bob Odenkirk's Jimmy McGill, a.k.a. Saul Goodman, on AMC's Breaking Bad prequel, Better Call Saul. Ray Seahorn. Over the course of our conversation at the offices of The Hollywood Reporter, the 47-year-old and I discussed her evolution from a character actress to a leading lady with a character actress's approach, what she learned from the various short-lived TV series that preceded Better Call Saul, how she landed the part of Kim on that Vince Gilligan and Peter Gould drama series and came to play the character the way she does, never better than on its most recently aired season, its fourth, what she suspects the future holds for Kim, who, unlike Jimmy, Mike, or several other Better Call Saul characters, is never seen or referenced on Breaking Bad, plus much more. So without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Ray, thank you so much for joining us. Great to have you. We always begin with just a few basics on this podcast. Where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living?
Oh, interesting. Okay, Norfolk, Virginia. That was not the question I was expecting for some reason. And I have listened to your podcast. Norfolk, you. Virginia. And my mom did many, many jobs with the government. Norfolk's a big naval base, and we moved around a lot with my mom working on several bases in different capacities. But my dad, we were civilian, but my dad was an NIS agent for counterintelligence stuff. So we moved for that reason.
So NIS, National Intelligence, what's that?
Naval Intelligence. And I think that's changed to, someone out there will correct me, I'm sure. I want to say the acronym now stands for Naval Investigative.
Oh, okay.
But at the time it was intelligence.
So you're moving around throughout your childhood. How do you think that affects a kid?
I think you learn to adapt pretty quickly. I'm sure there's all sorts of studies that having to change schools and change friends and all of that, that often. I didn't move every 3 years like many people that have to move for the government do. We moved every 3 years for a while, and then we came back to Virginia Beach, and then we're there for a long time. But that being said, I would guess that the pros and cons probably end up being a wash. Yeah. As far as, like, if you stayed in one school in one town, K through 12, there's got to be pros and cons to that. And likewise, moving around. Yeah, you learn how to adapt. And it's very possible that it's part of what I do for a living. Yeah. That ability to just figure out how to read a room and
blend in, what's your cog in the wheel.
Yeah, blend in or stand out, depending on the circumstance.
Right.
Yeah.
So people might assume, because of your profession, that you were one of these, you know, theater kids that knew from as far back as you can remember that this is what you wanted to do. My sense from prepping for this is that was not the case. It was sort of a different form of the arts. So what was that?
Yes, I did fine arts for a long time. I still do it just for myself, but I don't do it for a living or try to do it for a living anymore.
It was sort of the family thing, right?
Yeah, my mother and father are both... He's passed away, and my mother still is. They're fantastic storytellers and very, very funny people and very smart people. So that was always going on in the house, that kind of performance, plus being from the South, my mom, Maryland, my dad, Tennessee, like Southerners on a porch can do some good storytelling. Mm-hmm, but in addition to that, yes, my father also painted and drew charcoal drawings a lot that he learned from his mother, my grandmother. And as far back as I can remember, both my sister and I were sort of given that, taught that, and encouraged to do that, drawing and sketching as a way to self-soothe. It was very much something that you did alone and didn't need an audience for, and that's a great thing. And it turns out to still be a great thing with my current profession, to just, I think, to have the ability, whatever it is that somebody wants to do as a hobby, to have the ability to self-soothe and to process things alone without a need for a committee's approval or to be overstimulated. I mean, it is stimulating doing art, but it's meditative. It's very meditative. The hand-eye coordination, and I still am attracted to when I'm trying to learn lines and then when I'm really trying to, sometimes I refer to it as like cracking a scene. It's mm-hmm. it's the math of the scene, and I can't, there's a million ways to play it, but if I can't find my way in yet, I'll go over and over it, and I tend to gravitate towards doing activities that are very methodic hand-eye coordination when I'm trying to figure it out.
Well, so all the way through high school then, we're talking no acting classes, no school plays, none of the stuff that people might assume.
No.
So now you go off to George Mason University. What happened there that changed that?
I was doing a BA in fine arts there, and you had to take another elective that's not what your major is.
Right.
And I wanted to, I was obsessed with television and film and particularly older stuff, because when I was growing up, Nick at Night was not children's programming at all. It was all black and white older television shows.
Really?
Oh yeah, I thought B. Arthur hung the moon as far as I was concerned. I was obsessed with Maude and anything with Madeline Kahn in it, watching older Saturday Night Lives, Gilda Radner and Jane Curtin and Lorraine Newman, and then also watching a lot of foreign films and French films, and I was so in love with it. And there was definitely, when I look back on it, this part of me that wanted to be a part of that. And I would write stories and do these mini monologues and impressions of family members for my sister constantly. and I wanted to be a part of that. But I thought that, and maybe not wrongfully so, looking at American television and film, particularly in the 80s and 90s, I thought you had to be from Hollywood, from a family that's in Hollywood, or look like a model if you're a girl. I thought those were your options, and I didn't fit the bill on any of those.
Well,
three.
I got to interrupt here, because I couldn't believe this when I, you know, read it, but we know the way you look from Better Call Saul and the way you look today out in the world. You're saying it was like majorly different at a certain point, right? What can you describe?
When I first started acting, yes. I was... Well, I had taken an acting class. I think I had just enrolled, and maybe it started my first year of college, when, and I looked pretty much like me, plus the, you know, the lovely freshman 10. but I was very unhealthy, I gotta say. I ate horribly and no one exercised. I did not grow up with a family that, I don't know if that was just my family or suburbs of Virginia or the decade we're talking about, but I grew up with, like, we all knew the one weird mom on the block who jogs, and isn't that weird? She jogs, and we'd look at her out the window. So, yeah, I came into it pretty unhealthy, but then my father passed away at the very end of my first year of college, and I went through, as you might guess, a lot of searching and transformation and rebellion. Yes and no. He died of alcoholism. So... it wasn't like any of us were surprised that the road ended that way. But I can't believe I'm talking about this. But as a child of an alcoholic, I think a lot of people would agree that you almost start to just think the end might come at any moment. So then you get inured to that. And so then, in a way, it is a surprise when it's like, oh my gosh, wow, it really happened. Okay.
Right.
So I did what I thought was so rebellious, but apparently a lot of people do this. I later read, I chopped all my hair off. I had long, straight blonde hair, and I chopped it off and then buzz cut. It was crew cut, and then I dyed it jet black.
Who is this? Was this like Sinead O'Connor? I'm trying to think.
I don't know what. I wasn't even like holding a magazine picture of someone I idolized. It just... I don't know. I look back on, I was 18, and I think you feel limited in how to express the chaos that's happening. And so maybe changing your appearance dramatically. I mean, cutting off really long blonde hair that I'd had forever was fairly dramatic to me at the time. And then I proceeded to eat and rarely leave the bed for that summer. And so I say all of that to say that I got very unhealthy and gained a lot of weight. So by the time I was telling my college teachers and friends that I wanted to act for a living. Mm-hmm. I just was in love with acting the first time I took a class, because it was the first time, and they were teaching Lenny Rabach, one of my favorite and most beloved mentors. Her class, she was teaching practical aesthetics, the David Mamet Atlantic Theater kind of approach. It's the first time I heard about objectives and obstacles and given circumstance. And what happened in my brain was, you took the magic of storytelling and the fact that I loved the idea that someone's job was to tell grown adults stories, and that we still, like children, will sit around waiting to be told a story and waiting to be taken somewhere from point A to point B. And then if you're good enough at the storytelling, you can take somebody anywhere. On a black box stage with nothing, you can tell me that we're on Mars. Sci-fi, French films, film noir, dramatic things. I could put myself in someone else's footsteps for a beat and come out the other side thinking differently. And so that, when that magic met what I found out was actually a craft, then that hand-eye coordination part of me that loves math. I mean, not, well, the math of the craft of acting, if that makes sense, to break down a script.
Yeah, how you do it.
Yeah. Those, and you can apply yourself. It's not just magical fairy dust that some people are better at this than other people. It's work. It's something you can apply yourself to. It's something that's bigger than luck and more important than looks. It's a thing I can study. So when those came together, I immediately was hooked. And then I went through this period after my dad died that sort of altered my appearance.
Well, let me ask you, though, that first acting class preceded your dad dying, or it was...
Preceded it.
Okay, so you were already heading in that direction, but now...
Yes,
okay.
But telling people that I wanted to do this for a living, because I went to George Mason near Washington, D.C., because I actually thought I wanted to do exhibition curating and exhibition design, and so I thought I would intern at the Corcoran or the Smithsonian or something like that, looking for a way to, like, how am I going to financially make it as a painter?
Yeah,
And then I just immediately fell in love with acting, and I just thought, I have to do this for life. I have to. I love thinking about what makes other people tick obsessively, and I'm people watching all of it. And so anyway, the appearance thing just affected me in that. And listen, I look back and I look at those pictures, and I think we should be accepting women of all different shapes and sizes, and I think I was... cute as a button, just a little bigger and a little more androgynous looking because of my hair and stuff like that. But
how did that affect the sorts of castings? I mean, so you're taking the acting classes. Mm-hmm. I guess, are you also in college productions and stuff while you're still at George Mason, or was that only afterwards?
I was in a few, but not many. There are really, really great acting teachers and art teachers, actually, at George Mason University. Primarily because a lot of them are adjunct. It's a commuter type school, so there's no coddling. And most of your teachers have a gallery show tonight or are going on stage tonight.
Right.
And so there's a lot of pros and cons, back to the goods and bad of that. You need to figure your shit out.
Yeah,
do we curse on this
absolutely.
One? You need
on.
To figure your shit out. And for whatever reason... trying to remember, they do a type of ensemble acting thing where the same group of kids moves up together, and for whatever reason, I think it was because I was coming to it late. It wasn't my declared major. By then I had, for whatever reason, I needed to make it a minor and not a major, and so I sort of got left out a little bit of their normal curriculum, the way they do it. And so I did a lot of independent studies and didn't end up in college productions because I was a little bit outside of that loop, even though I got the benefit of all their wonderful teachers. But I started going downtown and...
Downtown D.C.
Sorry, going into D.C.,
yeah.
And at that time the City Paper, which is sort of like the Village Voice for D.C. Rest in peace. But I loved the Village Voice. But I was looking for community theater production, anything. And I started volunteering I would read stage directions for a new play in a church basement, anything, just because I felt acutely aware that I needed to figure out how to make this a profession that I could make a living from. And it felt to me that many people in the arts around me, not just my school, sort of either end up like my dad, relegating it to a hobby because you can't make it a profession, or sort of dreamy-eyed think that you're somehow just going to leave school and get hired professionally and forgetting to bridge that gap in some way. So I kept trying to actually volunteer in professional settings instead of at my school. Yeah. And I did get some thoughts about casting. Back to your original question, my apologies. But my appearance, I didn't think it was that different. And I gravitated towards theater because I started to go into D.C. Mm-hmm. and watch shows at. And if anybody out there has not seen theater in Washington, D.C., it is amazing.
Really?
It is amazing. One of my greatest accomplishments to this day is that I'm an acting company member at Woolly Mammoth Theater. And they're phenomenal. And so is Arena Stage. And I used to work at Studio Theater and Source Theater. They are often doing, especially Woolly Mammoth and to some degree Arena, doing productions that are taking bigger risks. Like we had Nikki Silver coming to do stuff and Doug Wright and Amy Friedman and Diana Sun and Paula Vogel was working on a piece at Arena. And often the playwrights would actually work out new things and take even bigger risks because it is a professional, very literate theater audience there. And the Washington Post is reviewing you and it is a big deal. But they could sort of really jump without a net before taking that production to New York.
Right.
And it didn't mean that the New York production was necessarily better or worse, which some people might think that about New York theater versus other places. It meant that we really workshopped some of these characters and the lines and tried to see how far can we push the audience and what's provocative versus shock. And it was amazing.
After you graduated, you were staying in that area doing those
theater for 12 years in D.C.
Well, and so I think you...
My appearance early on, I got slapped in the face to find out that this package doesn't work for all the roles. Now in theater, thank God, it's a little more forgiving than on camera at that time. On camera, it's gotten a lot better now. But what happened is they wouldn't let me... I didn't realize that no one was going to let me play any ingenue roles.
Did you want to?
In some of them, yeah. In some plays, that was clearly the most interesting part to me. Not because they had the most lines or were the leads or anything like that, but just they often were given the most to do or whatever at first.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up actually being wrong, I think, because what my packaging appeared to people, and I also was very, I always had this voice, which lower register is odd to some people coming out of a young person.
Call. I wanted to ask you about when that came along, because that's
always
distinctive.
Been that way, and I've always been very forthright, and I make eye contact, and while I fight deep insecurities and self-esteem issues and always have, and certainly was then, I still can hold my place in a room, and I'm okay to take up space. I've always felt fine about that, and that juxtaposition with my appearance and my forthrightness to people, they were like, "You're a character actor. You're only allowed to play the character parts." Some pretty awful things were said to my face when I attempted to audition for things that were not the character part, that role, we have to get somebody that is attractive to men. Was one of the reasons that I was not allowed to read for one role. And yes, I have seen that person since then. And yes, I did bring that story up at an awards ceremony because I'm awful.
God.
But what it ended up being the greatest gift. I played all the strange friends and the people who have deep secrets and the people who are fighting addictions and the crazy friend who's in an asylum, all these fantastic parts. And the reliance was deeply on, I need to make myself a better actor somehow, some way, every single day, because apparently my looks are not going to carry me.
And so at what point did you, and why did you then abandon that? It sounds like sort of more butch, is that the word?
I don't even know that it was butch. It just didn't look commercially what we think ingenues look like. I was probably 40 pounds heavier, too, which, again, not horrible to look at or anything like that, but just wasn't fitting certain packages. It changed actually just because I started getting work. I started professionally working while I was still in college. And even though it was non-union theater, but it was professional, I always say, as long as somebody's buying a ticket and my school didn't get it for me, that's professional to me. And I was so tired. I was doing school and, a day job and then rehearsing. And I realized pretty quickly, wow, for every hour you're rehearsing, you can count on at least another hour at home that you should be working on your stuff and studying and tired. And part of it was skipping meals, thinking that that was a good way to lose weight, but then eating a pizza or a cheeseburger at 2 o'clock in the morning and going straight to bed and not exercising at all. And I was just tired. I was so tired. And I thought, I got to get some energy. And I know it sounds like crap, but I honestly started there. So it's like, I think I need to get healthier because I want to do this for a living. And I got like eighth grade health books and like relearned what a portion was. It's not what Cheesecake Factory is putting on my plate. And I did really small things. Like the whole first year, I just told myself, oh, apparently I'm supposed to drink this much water.
Right.
I don't drink any water. I don't even drink a cup of water. That's weird. So all I did was add water, all the water you're supposed to drink. And I started to feel a little bit better. And I also had a lot of anxiety and even the depression stuff after my dad passing away. And luckily, I had parents, and my mom was great too. She was very supportive of me doing whatever. She still is. Mm-hmm. There was no blinking from my family about like, what, you're gonna be an actor?
You're gonna get in this, yeah.
No. It was more like, well, whatever she says she's gonna do, she's gonna dig her heels in, so just let her go.
And you're telling them at that point that your dream is you're gonna be a, or forget about dream, just I'm gonna be a theater actress. It's not, screen was not in the equation for a while, right?
I think I didn't. Yeah, I wanted to because I grew up. I didn't grow up going to theater. Right. We didn't. I think we had one field trip to go see Julius Caesar, and it was not good. And it's too bad. It's too bad, right? Because when I did a workshop with some youth at risk once, I was trying to tell them, like, I swear to you, there's plays that will affect you, make you laugh, make you cry, make you think, make you re-examine some things as much as any television show or movie that you've seen. You just need access to it. And DC does a lot of that, pay what you can and free for, you know, students coming in on certain days and stuff like that for the newer contemporary theater. Not that the classics aren't great, they are, but I wanted to tell these kids there's even stuff that you wouldn't guess would speak to you. So I wanted to do on camera because I grew up watching film and television that I was obsessed with. I guess, you know what? I'm not sure. When I look back on it, it's an interesting question because when I look back on it, I'm guessing it was just another thing that I thought was just outside my reach. At first, acting seemed outside of my reach, then getting on stage was, and then being on camera, I think at that point. And I, all the time, and at the time, I was losing weight and getting healthier, but also becoming a better actor with every job I did. And so I started being offered a wider variety of parts, but I still approached them the same way I did from the beginning. And then that became a casting issue. And it was in television as well that now people were like the opposite, thinking, well, okay, so she's a cute blonde, but she refuses to just be the girlfriend. Right. Like, I constantly infuse everything with subtext of like, oh, no.
What's
there's
my
a
backstory?
Whole life going on here while I sit and smile at my husband.
Right.
Yeah. And not everybody wants that in their story.
Well, before I think any screen acting entered the picture, as you said, there were these many years of theater. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I have to ask you about, because you said it was in D.C., but it seems like from late 2001 to early 2002, there was also a little Broadway experience.
Yes, I acted in New York for 3 years as well before I came out to L.A. And I was an understudy to Julie Lunn, who's fantastic, in Neil Simon's 45 Seconds from Broadway. That was his love letter to the Edison Theater. And I was her understudy, and I got to go on, and that was my Broadway debut.
That's great. How far ahead of going on did you know you were going to get to go on? Like, could you tell people, like, come see me because tonight's the night or whatever?
Yeah, I think I had, like, 2 days' notice because she got food poisoning, and I feel like they knew over the weekend that I might be going on. I might be wrong. Maybe it was a Monday, and I went on Tuesday. I'm not sure. And, oh, my gosh, that cast was... I was extremely prepared, though, because Jerry Zaks was the director, and he insists that all understudies watch all rehearsals every day. You must be there for every hour, and you all must be in the building, not with a... get this, pager, anybody remember those? Or cell phone down the block during performance. An entire second cast lives in the basement during production.
Just kind of hanging out.
Yeah, and you're listening to the speaker because he used to tell us it's awesome. Back then, it felt like tyrannical and I was terrified, but it was amazing because first of all, it was a masterclass in acting watching these. It was David Margolies and Alex Corey and Louis Zorich and Louis Statlin, Bill Moore, the fabulous, amazing Marion Seldes. Oh, yeah. It was all Tony Award winners up there rehearsing. So I was perfectly happy watching them.
Yeah.
Kevin Carroll, who's now a friend of mine and a huge TV and film star himself. But you had to be down there, and he would tell us, Jerry would say, if you hear on the speaker, on the PA system, that you hear somebody fall, I expect you to be able to complete their line without the audience knowing it. Obviously, not possible,
yeah, right,
but that's
right.
How on edge we were supposed to be, thinking we might go on.
But that must have felt pretty great to be at that point. What could be better than being on Broadway?
It was amazing. It was. And this was, we were previewing during 9/11. And I was living in Brooklyn at the time. So it was a very weird time.
Yeah. Maybe that's why it didn't even go longer.
It didn't go long. The hardcore subscribers were still trying to prove that we're still going to the theater and we're still going to carry on. But Times Square, there was tumbleweeds going by. And also the anthrax thing started right after 9/11. So then no one was on the subway and everyone was telling people don't go to large gathering places like Times Square, don't ride public transportation, and we're doing all of that.
Yeah.
I think we resumed preview rehearsal maybe only like a week after 9/11, and I hadn't even gotten out of my pajamas. I was terrified, and my boyfriend at the time in Brooklyn, we took turns leaving NPR on all night on their alert channel because you still didn't know, like, is this done or are they bombing? Are they going to continue bombing? Nobody knew, and I watched the Twin Towers go down out my window.
You saw it go down.
Yeah. And then I remember getting the call, and I forget his name, my stage manager, saying, okay, tomorrow's rehearsal. And he was just very matter of fact. Tomorrow's rehearsal, 9 a.m., blah, 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 blah. And then we're going to do a preview. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
Are you insane?
Yeah.
We're not rehearsing a play? Are you rehearsing a comedy? This is crap. Mm-hmm. No way. And I hung up the phone, and I just thought it was ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And I got to tell you, the next morning... Mm-hmm. I just started crying because I realized how thankful I was to be told what to do. Mm-hmm. To be told, put your pants on, put your shoes on, you're going outside,
so
and
it
you're
actually
getting
did go forward.
Oh yeah. And you're getting on that L train and you're going to rehearsal.
Wow.
And I was so hot, and there was like four people on the subway, and everybody waves at each other. Hey, what's up? It was so weird. And then we got there, and Jerry did this beautiful speech about, God, I wish I could remember. It's from someone. It's not Mark Twain. Hopefully somebody out there knows. You have to call me when you find out who this author is. But it has to do with when the world is at its worst and chaos is its greatest. That's when we need the arts the most.
Wow.
And everyone was thrilled to have any purpose at all in that moment.
How long after that was it that you moved to LA, and why did you do that?
I was doing a play at the wonderful, amazing Playwrights Horizons and auditioned on a videotape. It was videotape. Everybody would always say, like, if you want to do pilot season, if you ever want to do television, you have to go to LA for pilot season. And obviously everybody knows, and I'm sure it's the same in your profession. It's the same in every, there's no always, never, anything. There's all different paths. Granted, the likelihood of being seen in a casting room for a television show at that time was more likely if you were physically here.
Mm-hmm.
But I was afraid. By that time, I was working in plays blissfully a lot. I worked constantly and felt like I was always making myself better with every play, every scene. And I did want to do television and film, but back to what you asked a while ago, there was something about it that thought, like, well, they'll never accept me anyway, so what am I going to go there and get off a bus and be like, who needs a Caucasian blonde? You don't have enough of those, do you? Woo! Like, I just thought that's ludicrous.
Right.
They're satiated. They're fine with that.
Right.
And
when did you get to town?
Well, I auditioned on this videotape, and then they wanted to do a studio test and a network test, which at the time I didn't know what those were. And my agent and I were like, what? And so I went in. It was for this great role on I'm With Her, and it was to play Terry Polo's little sister.
This is an ABC sitcom.
Yeah, and Chris Henchy, Marco Panett, based on Chris Henchy's real life of dating when a regular guy tries to date a celebrity because he married Brooke Shields, who's amazing and lovely, and I've met her as well. Yeah, and I...
But that was literally the early on, upon arriving out here, that was one of the first things? Or that was the thing?
Oh,
that...
I got it, and then it got picked up, and they moved me here. I came with
a
job, which is pretty much the best way
amazing.
To come to
Yeah. And that was, I think, basically it lasted a season, 22 episodes. But I mean, we should remind people that maybe it was not that dissimilar to doing theater because you're doing it in front of a live audience,
correct.
Right?
It was a multicam live audience show. So you rehearse the whole week leading up to whatever your show night is. And then on show night, you sort of do this. For anybody in theater, it looks just basically like tech rehearsal all day. And then that night you do a live performance. And I did tell this one story. I think it was at the Geffen for a charity thing. But people were a little concerned, the producers, not in a crappy way, but people were trying to make sure that I was okay with anything that was not familiar to me, like A camera, B camera, C camera, mm-hmm. this, that, and the other. But a lot of the staging, the proscenium style staging, I'm very used to. Yeah. And for some reason, though, they kept warning me about show night, like, just so you know, there's going to be a live audience out there. And so I guess a lot of people that had only done on camera right. acting, like, get freaked out. I'm not really sure. I was like, right, yeah, yeah. And they were like, all of those seats are going to, there's going to be people. And I was like, right. okay, yeah, I got it.
Right.
And then they told me, but here's the thing. When we do the live show, we're going to do it. It's almost like a play, right? We're going to do the whole thing. And then if there's stuff we have to work on, like a scene's not working, we actually let the audience go. You don't want to exhaust them. They'll go and then we'll stay and work it out if something needs to be done over and over. And I thought, oh, okay. So what I, I thought they literally meant we're going to do a 30-minute play
yeah.
without stopping. There will be no second takes of anything. If you need a second take, if you mess anything up, right. we're going to do it later tonight. So what happened was in sitcom staging, there's these sets. If you, I'm sure you've seen a live one, but anybody at home listening that hasn't, they almost look like little shoebox stages, and the cameras are sliding. The 3 to 4 cameras, usually 4, is sliding up and down and moving on location to location. And so in the script, I think I'm in the first scene, and it's at home. And the second scene takes place in a cafe. I think it was a cafe that was the stages at the, that was the set that was at the end of the stage, mm-hmm. the furthest away. And then it's a different day and I'm in a different costume. So I spent the entire week rehearsing, looking at that going, and I had a number of these that came up and right. I kept thinking,
how's that gonna work?
That's an insane quick change. And I was used to, like, you know, at arena stage, you know, I had these fabulous right. dressers that, like, they basically rip your clothes mm-hmm. off, that are Velcroed and throw things on you, and you run outside and it's run back on stage and it's amazing. But I didn't notice any dressers. There didn't seem, and we're not even doing like a rehearsal of that. So I kept watching the other actors, David right. Sutcliffe, Danny Comden, and Terry Polo, who are all very experienced television people. And Ted Wass was the director. And everyone's like, he's from Blossom. And I was like, forget that. He's from Soap. That's what I grew up watching him on. And I thought, I'm waiting till someone else asks about their quick change. I don't want to be, because I'm thinking the whole time I'm going to get right. fired. They're yeah. just going to realize, like, you know, she's good, but she cannot pull this off. Right. So I don't want to say anything about anything. The entire week, I never asked for anything. And right. I was like, somebody will ask eventually, right? Because that's not possible. Nobody ever asked. So then I went to my fitting and I asked the costume designer if all of my things could be changed to Velcro and like pull on like elastic things. And she's looking at me.
Like, what is going on?
Yeah. Like, yeah. are you disabled? Like, why can't you? Like, they gave me right. tennis shoes. And I was like, right. can you make them pull on though? Can you change it to elastic laces? So they just pull on my jeans. I asked it, like, can you change this to an elastic waistband? They were like,
did she finally get why you?
No, I never told. To this day, I've never gone back and told. But I mean, I had a button up thing right. and everything became slip on, like Garanimals. I was like a toddler.
Wait, so they did actually
accommodate
your... They
changed all my stuff because I think they were thinking, I don't know, maybe she's just a weird actress yeah. and I don't want to upset her or maybe something's wrong with her. She has no dexterity. I don't know. So I get all my clothes changed to children's clothes.
Oh my God.
And you can still watch it. I'm wearing like sweatpants.
That's hilarious.
And I changed the blocking in the first scene. Like, I'm supposed to like be talking and then I exit, but I kept changing it to the line is actually on the exit. Cause in my head, I was just trying to plan how many seconds I could do to this quick change. And then at Warner Brothers, your dressing rooms are above the stages. They're in the same building. They're not like a trailer somewhere. So they set your costume changes up there. Because for anybody who doesn't know out there, the end of the story involves like when you film a show, you stop 100,000 times and then you go change clothes and you come back down and someone redoes your hair and makeup.
Right.
So I took they set my costumes up there on show night and I took them down and I hid them behind all the sets. And then we did the show and sure enough, we do the first take and of the first scene. And I'm literally, you can see, if you can find the show, you can see, I do my last line with just my head sticking out of a doorway because I am ripping
Ready
my clothes off. I am taking my clothes off while I'm speaking.
That's
behind a door. And then I bolted down behind all the stages past like the ABC execs are back there and people's invited guests. And I'm busting ass running, ripping my clothes off, go flying over a C-stand, bloody shin all over the place. I get my clothes back on. I'm sweating and heaving. And I go into the cafe and I'm ready. I'm ready with my first line, but it's pitch black. And I hear them yell, cut. And Ted Wallace is like, let's go again. Where's Ray? I'm like, fuck.
Now you got it.
Only then do I look from the audience side all the way down the soundstage, and I see like, oh, wow, they're going to go again. Okay, yeah. And he's like, what are you wearing? Bloody shin, different costumes, sweating.
Oh my God.
I never told any of them.
That's
I think
a great
they just
story.
Think I'm a lunatic. I've never told anybody that worked there what
that
I was
is
doing.
Great. That's hilarious. Well, yeah, now with all the TV experience, you can really laugh at that. Oh my God. Well, okay, so that show was 2003 through 2004. Then, unless I missed something, the next real like series regular was Whitney, which is 2011 to 2013. So what was going on in the 7 years between that? Was
it's
that a
so sad that on paper it looks like I?
I'm not saying you didn't do anything. There's a lot of credits.
No,
there.
I did so
no,
many
of course.
Pilots.
Okay, so that's what
that didn't make it, including a couple of shows I did. Singles Table, which mm-hmm. was brilliant. I loved that with John Cho, Alicia Silverstone. Mm-hmm. That was Mike Schiff and Bill Martin. And that one we did 6 episodes mm-hmm. for Fox. I want to say mm-hmm. Fox. Writer's strike happened and it didn't air. Yeah. And what else? Head Cases, Bill Chase's show. We did six episodes of that. And I think they aired 3 of them. But yeah, I was actually continually.
It was
working.
Never like you were struggling to get a job or what. But is it demoralizing when you get invested in a new project and then it goes 3 episodes, if that? And, you know, like, I mean, it's not uncommon. A lot of the people that we talk to here, but I mean, I would still think it beat you down after a while. You think that this is going to be the one that
right.
takes it to the next level, and then
right. Well, I would guest star on things that were on, so but it did. You do feel after a while like, is all my work in a vacuum? Like, what's happening? And then some of them, you know, you just love too. I loved Head Cases. I particularly loved Eva Adams, Kevin Falls pilot that I think now would get on, but at the time mm-hmm. was just too odd. It was a remake of an Argentinian show, and I was playing. It's a misogynist man who has a curse put on him one day and wakes up as a woman, and he's a sports agent. And so it was me playing Will Arnett trapped in my body.
Oh, that's great. That's funny.
And it was so much fun, but yeah. they just didn't, they were struggling. The network was like, because again, this was a while ago. Yeah, they were like, what is the love interest mm-hmm. going to be? Like, either way, it's gay, right? No matter if she's with a man or a woman. And we were like, yes, isn't that fantastic? But they weren't ready for it at
yet.
The time.
Yeah.
And also like, okay, so and that was my first lead and a titular lead on camera. And again, you know, back to how we started the whole thing, it was character driven.
Yeah.
It was the first time that they've figured out like, oh, what's cool about her looking one way, but her personality being another way is this. And so it was some of the first meetings I had where the network couldn't say, well, what if she was wearing lower cut shirts? Or because my character had no idea how to dress herself.
Right.
And she's walking around in sweatpants. She uses the rubber band from a newspaper to just get her hair out of her face. And I walked like a guy, and
so
I
fun.
Talked. It was so much fun. And then also The Thick of It, I did with Michael McKean. That was Christopher Guest. That was the American and Mitchell Hurwitz, based on the British In the Loop and The Thick of It. Armand Iannucci, then eventually
yeah.
becomes Veep.
Oh,
that one crushed me that did not
yes.
go.
I want to go back for a second, though, to something you just said about, you know, notes from the network about lower cleavage.
Yeah.
Because you were obviously quite active in this pre-Me Too era of network television where, again, there are very specific things that they're looking for, sort of stock characters often and not and things that, you know, is this going to appeal to this demographic and we've got to get young males and we've got to do all this.
Sure.
Were you encountering bullshit like that? Not necessarily even like reaching the level of, you know, stuff that's come out in the last...
Sexual harassment.
Yeah, but just like stuff that, again, maybe the word would be demoralizing, like they're not seeing past the surface here.
Somewhat, yeah. I'm super grateful that I can say that I a couple of things. I'm grateful for many things, but I'm very proud of all the sitcoms I did, and I did a lot of sitcoms, and some aired and some didn't, but I did a lot. I did 10 years of sitcoms, and
yeah.
I think all of them were interesting, intelligent, great balances, and they were almost all broadcast networks, and balancing wide demographic appeal and then having the smart jokes threaded between that only like little niches will laugh at. Super smart writers.
should we just quickly mention? So Whitney is on NBC from 2011 to 2013.
Yeah.
Then Franklin and Bash was on TNT, I guess overlapping to some
overlapping.
Extent.
Overlapping. Yeah. I guest starred on that for six seasons, I think. Mm-hmm. And that was Kevin Falls and Bill Chase, and they were lovely to me that I couldn't be a series regular with them because I was tied up in other shows and even some shows that didn't air, but the contracts never worked out. And I love working with them, and I'm very proud to say that I think they love working with me. Hopefully they still do. So we constantly found a way to make that work. I did that overlapping with many shows.
Yeah, but you're saying, so you had pretty much positive experience.
I did. You know what I encountered more seemed like the people whose job it is to make network shows a business. I feel like some of those people were concerned, and you'd catch wind of it even if they tried to keep it behind the scenes. You could tell that they were concerned with not just appearance of the female characters, but likability. And that bummed me out, because a part of me understood, well, it's a commercial business, and I understand that you need to not offend people on certain networks in certain time frames. But at the same time, the definition of likability and the parameters of that felt a lot tighter than it did for the male characters. So it wasn't so much being harassed or demoralized as much as feeling thwarted creatively sometimes when the writers, the producers and directors totally were all for what I wanted to do. And I'm watching the male character next to me be allowed to push those limits, to do things that they seem like a no-brainer, but they're not. To be allowed to get angry in a scene and not let everyone know it's okay at the end. Mm-hmm. Most of the females end up having to, and believe me, now I watch sitcoms, there's all sorts of people that are breaking the rules I'm talking about, and for whatever reason are in positions where they're allowed to do that. So there are very smart women in sitcoms on right now. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I felt that pressure in a way that seemed gender-based. And then there were also times where I felt like, every now and then, it's not so much what's said to you, it's that you're spoken to differently than your male counterpart. I sometimes felt like direction seemed more craft-based to the male, and more, not all of my, but Ted Wass is me, I can list, mm-hmm. and I've had far more amazing directors, mm-hmm. but just since we're having this discussion, there were times that I felt like the direction, and you can even see it in reviews sometimes, and they've gotten better, but theater reviews can sometimes, actually any acting reviews, can sometimes tend towards the, like, she has a magical quality. She's effusive and has that certain thing. And ethereal. Then they're describing them, ethereal, quirky, blah, blah, blah. And then the male character, the actor, they're describing his abilities, mm-hmm. what brilliant choices, the skill involved with X, Y, Z. And then the woman comes on and they're just like, just gorgeous. Just that unspeakable quality. What can you say?
Yeah.
And so sometimes the direction that I got over the years also felt imbalanced mm-hmm. in that way. So yeah, stuff like that.
Yeah. So, all right. Whitney ends 2013. Franklin and Bash ends 2014. And it seems like right about that time, you get an audition for a show that I don't even know if it was yet titled Better Call Saul. But this is a story that I want to kind of prompt you to tell, because I think it will make every actor who is working hard and not yet really getting the chance to show fully what they can do feel that the daily struggle of that is worth it. Because the story of your audition process mm-hmm. is just kind of awesome, right? I mean, the way it all, who did you audition for and what was your feedback?
Sharon Bialy, Sherry Thomas, Russell Scott, Bialy Thomas casting, and they, like a number of casting directors, Allison Jones, there's a handful of casting directors here in LA who are so great at their job, but also took the time to be encouraging of me whether or not I got the job.
Because for how many years had you been seeing them?
For Bialy Thomas, I had auditioned. It had to have been 10 years. Mm-hmm. And I was working, and I do want to say, because someone else asked me about the story recently, and I want to say, I am aware that what I was going through and that struggle is not nearly as debilitating as an actor who's not getting any work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm simply saying for them, I never got cast. But I was, as we've discussed, I was in shows that went or didn't go or guest starring. So I do understand that it's the few times in my life where I've had a dry spell where there was no outlet for my creativity is it's horrible. And it's, as I said, debilitating. So I'm not saying it was that, but it was a situation where I wasn't aware, coming from theater doing just as much drama as comedy, I was not aware that I would get pigeonholed as a sitcom actress when I got out here just because that was my first show. And then I got another sitcom. And you can only be so lucky that people are even thinking of you for anything.
And a sitcom actress, though, means kind of like bubbly, fun, pretty, but not necessarily that deep.
Right, which also, by the way, not fair.
Right.
You ask anybody to name their favorite shows, and Cheers and All in the Family and Seinfeld and all these very character-rich shows that are very smart come up. So if you think sitcoms are dumb, then you watch dumb sitcoms. Right. I don't know what to tell you.
Although it has changed, maybe, in the sense of the amount of depth that, like, those shows that you just named were sort of pre-real rise of cable and streaming and all this, where, you know, it feels like the edgier character, the characters that can have more nuance are now not necessarily on the broadcast networks. Doesn't mean that every actress who's on a broadcast sitcom or whatever is not also excellent, but it feels like
there are more limited. There are smart people doing situational comedy, One Day at a Time, Blackish.
Yeah, right.
And then there's the rise of single cam ones too, which are not smarter, but allow you creatively to go through. I think Life in Pieces was really, really smart. And that was, I think, a hybrid. Maybe it was just single cam. So I hear you that I was naming the classic ones. And in some ways, maybe we took more risks then, you know? You go back and watch Mary Tyler Moore or even All in the Family. It's like, oh my God, if you tried to pitch All in the Family right now, I know it was just on live, but...
No, but we had Norman.
How about
Lear
we have a white old racist as your lead?
No,
would be like, what?
we just a couple weeks ago had Norman Lear on this podcast, and we were talking about the fact that, like, in some ways, they were edgier than you could be now. But so you though going into this audition though after 10 years had and by a lot of people been pigeonholed as sitcom actress,
and people like Sherry Bialy-Thomas and the casting, and as I mentioned, Allison Jones and a few others were calling me in for dramas and really dark comedies instead of lighter fare. And they did it once or twice, and then I guess liked what they saw and what I was bringing to stuff and continue to call me in for things that I think sometimes there just wasn't a chance in hell that I was going to get it. I even went in for some things for Sharon where I was acutely aware, like on deadline, that someone had already has an offer for the role.
Really?
And sometimes they just want backups, you know, if the contract doesn't work out or whatever. And not only was I willing, but I was so excited that they kept believing in me for this very wide range of roles, really, really, really pushing against my limits of even things I'd done on stage. Size of role, type of role, physical packaging of the role, calling you in for things where they only want names and I wasn't, but that, so what? We just want this director to see your work or whatever. Not only were they calling me in for those, but I was so thrilled to do these little mini 3-minute black box performances for these three super supportive people who also gave me direction all the time. They do give direction in casting sessions, which is awesome, and ask you to do it different ways and make adjustments. But they would also tell me, don't change the way you attack roles, right? The right people that you're supposed to work with will come. And it wasn't so much like the perfect role will come for you. It was additionally letting me know that it's okay that I keep adding subtext to the girlfriend that's just standing there and making and trying to add other layers to things. It's okay that I take up space in a room, and the people I should be working with that will make me a better actor and a richer artist for it will come along. And if somebody in that room does not like the way I work, I shouldn't be with them anyway, and it'll be okay. And so, yeah, they told me later that by the time they sent them, because Vince Gilligan and Peter Gould were already scouting locations in Albuquerque when the casting session started for my role, and tons of people were there in the hallway waiting.
It was huge.
And I had the pleasure of, I operate better from an underdog position, and so I was kind of like, well, obviously that'll just be an offer to anybody that they want, they'll get. So I'm going to do another 3-minute black box performance for Sharon Bialy, Sherry Thomas, and maybe they'll see it in there. And I know Patrick Fabian has said the same thing about his audition. We both kept thinking, well, do really, really well. Bring your A game.
Because who was in the room when you auditioned?
Aside, just them and a video camera. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, well, maybe if I do a good enough job, they'll call me in for like the waitress in episode 7 or something. Mm-hmm. Patrick felt the same way. But I also just approached it the way I had been approaching my roles for those guys for 10 years, meaning casting, that you have to love, and it, I know it sounds corny, but I say this to actors when I've coached them, you have to be in love with the actual work, that breaking down that script, that stuff that I told you I started with, that I fell in love with as much as the magical result. You have to be in love with making up characters. You have to be in love with staying home when everybody goes out on Friday night and thinking about this scene over and over and over again, and asking yourself to break it down, do your homework, and now push yourself to make the less obvious choice. What's a more interesting take on that line? What do you actually think the character's thinking about this? In this section where they don't speak at all, why don't they speak? What was that choice about? And if you're not in love with that part, you're always going to be in a situation where you're auditioning only for the result. And of course, I wanted the job, and nerves will get a hold of you because of that. But it is a tremendous weapon against those nerves to fill up your head with the energy it takes to make a little 3-minute portrait of someone that you love. This little sketch, this little painting, it took up all the RAM space in my head that day so that I didn't have room to be nervous.
Because what did you even know about him at that point?
Nothing. And by the way, they gave us fake sides, which happens a lot in auditions because they don't want the script to be floating around there, and sides up and down the hallway and in a trash can somewhere. So I knew nothing. I did not know she was a lawyer. She had a different name. And every callback I had was a new character that also was not Kim. So
how do you audition for a character when it's not even the character you're auditioning for?
Well, that's the thing you ask yourself first. And I sweated that out for a while going, okay, I'm going to try to guess like what they actually want the character to be one day. And it's like, that's a ridiculous, futile quest. So what you need to do is you need to play the fake character they made up the best you can. And it turns out every time they had these characters, they were qualities that they wanted to know that you were capable of should they arise in Kim. And you'd have to ask them how much they knew what she was going to be and where she was going to go beforehand. I don't know. But I just applied myself to the character that was there. And then I had a call back and applied myself to that character, which was new. And then by the time we did the network test / chemistry read, Opposite Bob. And then I was given real sides. And it was the scene, I think it's episode 3 of season 1, when he calls me at home and you're still very unclear about what their relationship is. Purposefully so. And I tell him, did you use the robot sex voice? And he's trying to ask me about the Kettleman case, and it's not exactly kosher. So that was my final scene that I had.
And the feedback you got was?
Well, first of all, Vince and Peter did it at the Sony a lot with Tom Schnauz there and Melissa Bernstein and Mark Johnson on my EPs. And they gave you direction, which was so fun. A lot of network tests, most network tests I've done, and I've been lucky enough to do many of them at this point. It's so terrifying. You're going into sometimes the conference rooms with a bunch of couches or something, and you get one shot. And if you mess up, or you just had an off day, or you got really nervous for some reason. One audition, I ruined it just because I realized I was sweating from nerves so badly that the sweat stains were so bad that I ended up having to do the whole audition like T-Rex because I didn't want to lift my arms. And I'm sure they were like, what is wrong with her? I did not get that part. But it's just stuff like that where you're like, you could have easily missed the best person for this role. Not always the best actor. It's not even a meritocracy some days, but most days. But somebody could have just been off. And instead, Vince and Peter, they taped it and you got to do it as many times as you wanted to until you felt good about it. Although for someone like me, I eventually told them, like, we're going to have to cut this out. If we wait till I think it's a great take, we would not be filming right now.
Right.
But it was a really supportive room.
And the casting directors, what did they say?
They were lovely. On my first auditions with them, they said I did a great job. And they later told me, Sharon later told me, that when they showed these first tapes to Vince and Peter, when they were narrowing down who was going to be in the final tests, they said, we got to tell them, here's a tape of her, but also listen to her range. And they told, they were, she's like, we were able to speak about a body of your work for a decade that no one has ever seen. And I'm going to get teary now. Because when Sharon told me, I teared up just because on paper, every single one of those auditions was a failure because I didn't get the job. But actually, they weren't. They were all successes because I, even when told you can't get the role, brought my A game, both because of my work ethic, but also because I love making up people. And doing it in front of people that are supportive, that want you to be great. Sharon and Sherry and Russell want you, and Vince and Peter for that matter. The energy in the room was always, I bet this is going to be awesome. Let's go. Instead of dance, dagnabbit, dance, you know, with a gun at your feet. And so they told me, yeah, they said, we were able to speak about your work ethic and your range, because they didn't totally know where Kim was going to go or what she might be one day, I guess, about work that, like I said, is technically all failures.
So that now, in hindsight, that all...
It all
contributed
mattered.
To the...
It all mattered, and I think right. It's a great thing to know and to remember that staying home that Friday night and being great every time, it does matter. The universe is hearing it. Somebody's seeing it and hearing it, and also you embolden the part of you that loves the part of this job that you have control over. Every time you feed that part of you that does what you do because you simply love it and would do it alone for no money in your basement, every time you feed that, it gets a little bigger than the part of you that feels like, I have no control over this. It's all up to everybody else. I have to wait for my big break. No one's helping me. I can't do this, you know. And I mean, you can make a web series this weekend on your phone, and people are like, but, you know, it's so crowded out there. No one's ever going to see it. No. What I'm talking about is making something. Make work that feeds you. Mm-hmm. And I know it's a super hard business to make a living at. And I know that I sit in a place of great gratitude for being where I am. But I do think it's important to love the work part of it, because you can control that.
So you get the part.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember specifically just your reaction in that moment? Because just for a second.
Bawling. I was bawling.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it took a really long time after that network test, screen test. And I don't know the ins and outs. I know that it wasn't to be sadistic and manipulative. I think it had to do with sending the tapes to some network people that couldn't be in the room that day and the back and forth. I don't really know.
Right.
At any rate, it took a while. And I actually thought it took so long that I was like, this is done.
Yeah.
Sometimes a callback can take a really long time to hear, but to have the screen test and not hear, I was just like, and I knew they were beginning shooting, and I was like, come on. So I tried to push down how devastated I was, because by that point, of course, the hope had arisen
so
in me.
Close,
like, oh
yeah.
My God, whatever. And only five people screen tested.
Wow.
And I was like, God damn it. And then Peter Gould started following me on Twitter, and I freaked out, and I went and told my fiance. I was like, you wouldn't do that if you weren't going to hire somebody, would you? Like, do you think it's a sign? He's like, hon, I don't know if we can be helpful, blah, blah. And then on my birthday, I think it was on my actual birthday, mm-hmm. May 12th, Graham, my fiance, was taking me out to dinner, and my agent called and manager and said that I got the job, and we were getting ready to walk into a restaurant in Venice, and I almost collapsed on the sidewalk. I was just, because I knew the level of storytelling that these guys do, and I also knew the amount of character development that they write, encourage, and enable in an actor. And I just thought there can't be a greater gift. And I wasn't wrong.
Well, so on the one level, obviously, as you're saying, there's this great excitement and anticipation. On the other hand, was there any part of you that's, as it sinks in, thinking, I'm joining a show that is almost on paper set up to fail, a spinoff of what some people think is the greatest show ever? How can anything, whatever it is, how can it live up to that? And are people just salivating, you know, do you get flashes of Joey from Friends, the spinoff, or all these ones where it just crashed?
Any comment on anyone else's
sequels or prequels? There you go. Right. But like, you know, I would think there's that as well.
Oh, sure. There's a gazillion things to be terrified, you know, and I'm talking a good game on your podcast, and then I go home and cry myself to sleep out of fear about everything every day. Yeah, no, I was scared for all sorts of reasons. Like, am I actually going to be able to contribute? Like, okay, you wanted to be on this A team, so are you going to hit? Like, what's happening? And then also the show itself. I mean, obviously it was set up to have backlash. Like, oh my God, there's going to be, even if we're great, there's going to be people that are just mad that we exist.
Right.
Because you shouldn't have touched the original, and blah, blah, blah. But a couple of things. I thought, A, and Bob has said this as well, even though he was a character from Breaking Bad, if Vincent Peter did not need the money or the notoriety. So you have to assume that people that smart and that talented, if they wanted to do it, they must have a story that they really want to tell. And I'm sure it's going to be great. What the audience decides to do with that, or trends or backlash, can't control. Yeah. I can't control any of that. And then I kind of had, in some ways, I felt less pressure that I was not one of the original characters. And I also didn't know, honestly, I didn't know at that point if Kim was in it some, a little, just recurring.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, at the beginning, it's not even clear what the nature of her relationship to Mm-mm. Jimmy is. And I don't know if you knew, because I know you're saying, you've said that you would get scripts not that far in advance of where
right.
the
no,
story
no, no.
is.
You get them about 3 to 5 days before you start shooting them.
So, you know, we knew in the early episodes that there was some history there.
Right.
But they weren't, you know, making out. It wasn't clear
right.
that they weren't talking about, you know, this, what the history was.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that was interesting. But additionally, now you've got to uproot your life for at least a chunk of the time and go to Albuquerque.
Sure. 4.5 to 5 months.
4.5 to 5 months. You're joining a group of people who have worked almost, I think a large portion of the people in front of and behind the camera have
yes.
worked together on Breaking Bad.
Correct.
They have history with each other. Was it encouraging or frightening to join that kind of a group of people that are already sort of familiar with each other in a place that's removed from everything else? Or, you know, because I'm thinking on the one hand, that's isolating enough to be with a group of people that know each other and you don't. And now on top of that, you're in the middle of nowhere. But on the other hand, what else is there to do but get to know each other and work with each other?
Yeah. Yeah. More the latter,
yeah.
I think. And as soon as I started getting the first couple of scripts, I realized, oh, this is of the fabric that Breaking Bad was made, but it is its own story. I think it would have been much more terrifying if it just felt like Breaking Bad season 7 or something. You know what I mean? Like, it felt like its own thing. And so I felt some relief from that. And then the crew and the cast was immediately embracing of me and very excited. And there was never any vibe of, you're the new person, just try and catch up with what we're
right,
doing.
Right, right.
It was more like, we're making a totally new thing together. And the people that are doing origin stories, because they are characters that existed in that, they have a particular type of job to do that's very interesting. But they were equally excited, and Bob being one of those people, about, like, you're a blank slate, right? Like, who is this character?
Right.
What is this? And so I think people were extremely inviting from the beginning. And me not knowing what that relationship was turned out to be some of the coolest little gifts I had to start trying to make Kim. I'm like, who is this person? She is extremely specific about what she says. She says very little. Mm-hmm. She shows very little. So I started letting all of those things be clues to me. We share a cigarette in that first episode. He takes a cigarette out of my mouth and puts it in his. That was written into the script. And I thought, okay, well, that's a level of intimacy
right.
that's deep. You don't do that
no.
unless you've known someone.
Right.
I don't know. I was like, I don't know if they are dating, mm-hmm. have been dating. But
how long till you
something's
found out?
It sort of grew over time. They said, yeah. They told us, they said, we think you guys have a 10-year deep history, each other's confidants, extreme close friendship. We're not sure what else it is or what else it used to be or what else it will be, but just play that.
That's scary. That's like, yeah, I would think because, I don't know, maybe I would think you behave a little differently around someone who you have a past intimate relationship with than
you do.
Who you don't.
You do, but so I had to just take what's there and
yeah.
end up making this character that I'm so fond of now. I mean, he also said, we only have one line together, and Jimmy says, couldn't you just, and I say, I can't.
Yeah.
And he meant, like, help me upstairs
right.
during his Ned Beatty monologue. So to me, I was like, okay, she has boundaries.
Right.
They know each
right.
other well enough, they finish each other's sentences
right.
and smoke the same cigarette,
right.
but she will cut him off in a heartbeat.
Yes.
And then in the script, it said, she throws a cigarette away, walks away. There was no, like, looks back with goo-goo eyes, thank
right.
God. Walks away, and it says, without looking, writes the trash can that he kicked in the beginning of the episode and gets on the elevator. And I thought, okay, so he does this all the time, and she cleans up his messes.
Right, right. That's a great hint.
Without being sentimental about it. And for me, that was a lot of information, actually.
Another thing that I read, you know, was helpful, maybe kind of from the least expected place. You go to your costume fitting. I guess to some extent it tells you something about your character, but in this case it really did.
Yeah, Jennifer Bryan is our amazing costume designer. And I went in and I had some ideas about the character at that point. And a lot of it was deductive math, working backwards. Like, if this is who you are, what do you think makes you that way? If you're someone that's that careful about what you say, then you're probably somebody who keeps things in and what's happening there. And they told me, we think that she met Jimmy starting in the mailroom later in life and then worked her way up in a law firm very quickly. I was like, okay, so to me, this person seems very concerned with trying to get a single finger in the crag of middle class to somehow pull yourself up and don't let go for fear of God. Just, hang on. And I was thinking that, and I go into the costume fitting and Jennifer Bryan, the first thing she says, she goes, so I have your suits here. She's like, you know, we're all going to like learn and grow with Kim and who she is together. She's like, it's not like I've been told a bunch of stuff that you don't know. But she's like, but there's just something about her that to me feels like she still has to shop at Marshall's for separates. She can't afford the designer suit yet, but she's trying to blend in and make it in this world that's a little bit outside of her reach. And I totally just teared. I sound like a crybaby on this podcast, but I just started tearing up because I thought, oh my God, oh, okay, so we're actually going to have costume and then makeup and hair was the same. These discussions that are deeply character-based, and it's something that I feel very protective about Kim over the journey of the five seasons now, and Jennifer Bryan feels the same, that the women I grew up with that were desperate to pull themselves up out of some situation by being at least lower middle class to middle class, that fear to not backslide and the energy it takes, especially as a woman in the shows in 2002, Albuquerque in a law office, which is male dominated, you don't change your purse. You don't change your jewelry.
That's how, on a regular basis.
Right. No, yeah. That's how we came about these decisions that like, she doesn't even change her jewelry. Right. And then it turned into, and she doesn't change her hairstyle. She doesn't have time for that. And so, yeah, my clothes, my suits, especially season one and season two, and they've grown. She's evolved a little bit and she has money from Mesa Verde and all this other stuff, but they would look like a navy blue suit, but they would actually be blue and black. And they were repeats. It was like two skirts and one jacket, like on rotation. Yeah, it was great. It was all part of it.
And, you know, some people look at these two characters who are at the center of the show and they say, what could they possibly have to do with each other? They're so different. But the reality, I want to just read back a couple of quotes and then ask for a reaction. But you've said that in season one, quote, I would just look at his loafers and know instantly why Kim loves Jimmy. He's fucking holding it together with a paperclip.
That's true.
Close quote. And then she's also this outsider who in her own way is barely holding it together. You had said, quote, Kim is an incredibly tightly wound character who is buttoned down and keeping it together with incredible willpower. Close quote. Basically, there are these core similarities, even if she maybe can hide it a little better than him, that does answer that question of why would these two people ever want to have anything to do with each other in the first place, which is pretty important. But one of the things I want to ask about you and Bob, because you have so many of these scenes together, which are often long takes with long back and forths, do you guys work together learning the dialogue? Are you allowed to veer from it and improvise? I know he has this whole history in improv. A part of me thinks you hire Bob Odenkirk, you want to make use of that skill set, and therefore now you're going to be doing it with them, that you can dance a little bit, but I'm not sure. So just learning and executing these long back and forths.
Right. Yeah, no, we don't improv. The scripts are done to the letter. Bob has said that he actually finds it to be this great relief that it's not his job. He's not writing the show. And it's some of the best writing he's ever seen. So he's thrilled to be doing that. I think they've told him maybe a handful of times or less, like when he's doing bingo at the senior citizens home and he's supposed to be working the crowd. Right. I think they told him he could add a joke or two if he wanted to. And sometimes early on, when you get your first draft of the script, you can ask about if Bob wanted to add a line or something. But I don't even think he does it that much. No, we do them to the letter. And so in order to have the freedom to explore these 4, 8, 10 page, just two people talking scenes that gloriously do not have a obvious arc.
Yeah.
They're not, oh, so it's two people talking and then they start flirting and then that thing comes up and they get in a huge argument and then it's done. It's this twisty tale that I find so accessible and so authentic about the way we talk to people that we've known very well.
Yeah.
We'll rehearse the lines ad nauseum over and over and over and over and over. Everyone in the cast does, because you don't want to use your takes about lines. You want to use all of the time we're given to perform to explore, especially with like the Jimmy and Kim characters. And Bob and I love, we've had these fantastic blow up argument scenes, but we also love the really quiet ones, because they are in some ways more challenging, and it starts to be about, there's what you say, but when you are with a partner for that long, it is so much about what you don't say and also what you say between the lines. And the slightest, when we were doing that bathroom scene,
just gonna say the bathroom,
if one of us looked away when we said the line, it made the other one, in character, I mean, you immediately perk up going, why can't you look at me when you say that? And that alters the way you say your next thing. Does it hurt more that somebody can't look at you? Or are they lying? Is it suspicious? What is it? Or to get close to someone, or to act like you might get up and leave. And all of those tiny things start to matter as much as the lines in performance. You've got to know them forwards and backwards in order to do that.
And I think you've said, though, that it's sort of your favorite moments are the ones where it's just two of them together, whether it's the nail salon or the parking garage or whatever, because when else do we ever see them actually, either of them, let their guard down and be their actual authentic selves? They're the only people that they would do that in front of. And then I guess as
they
we get in,
they both wear masks of a sort in public, and they don't with each other.
And then you get to season four, and as they're growing apart, who does she have to be honest in front of except the audience?
Yeah, and I have said that last season, season four, Kim believes it's out of grief, his grieving, that he is just becoming further and further distant, and his history of the awful relationship with Chuck.
Yeah.
She's increasingly alone, and you're right. She's without the even one person to let her guard down in front of, and it did feel like the audience became her closest confidant. They are frequently in season four, even in that wonderful scene by Tom Schnauz that Michelle McLaren directed in episode two, where Kim lets Hamlin have it over the state. In that instance, I am talking. I'm not being silent. But I still was like, the audience is the only person in the room that actually knows what all of this is about and why I'm losing it on him. And he's taking the brunt of years of her issues with Chuck and what Chuck did to Jimmy and the injustice and the unfairness of so many things in the world, and her coming up against the fact that I think Kim desperately, for whatever she came from, I think she thought legal and illegal would be the same as good and bad and moral and immoral, and they are not turning out to be at all. And it's deeply distressing to her that she cannot make order out of that.
And this then, is why she does her public defender. And
And, you know, and that is another reason why she's with Jimmy. In the beginning, people thought that that was more odd than they do now. But I thought, well, the pillars of justice in her life, the Hamlins and the Chucks, are the most duplicitous.
Right.
And lie to her face and squish her down and don't give her promotions and aren't fair and aren't ethical and are not moral and are terrible people. I mean, Hamlin didn't turn out to be terrible, but she thought he was at one time. Right. Chuck is a terrible person. Terrible. I love Michael McKean. Yes. And I know he will. I know he had to play him as though Chuck is
right.
But Jimmy, who's supposedly a con man, totally upfront and honest. Totally tells her. Yeah. And then, you know, some of that eroded last season. And I think that's when we saw Kim get blindsided.
Well, so season four is the one that we've most recently seen. And, you know, as we move towards the end here, I've got to ask you about a few of them. You anticipated the first one, season four, episode two, where you're confronting Howard about this treatment of Jimmy. Just, I'm going to hit a few of these. So just maybe a sentence or two about each, just what, don't let me limit you, but I'm just saying, like, I want to hit a few of these. And let's start with that one. Just what it was like to prep for it, to do it, whatever stands out as you think about it.
I love that scene. I love Patrick Fabian, Michelle McLaren, and Tom Schnauz. It was a great scene. And Michelle and I worked on it coming from a place of what did Kim intend to say versus what took over when she started to try to tell him something. I think she meant to confront him. I do not think she meant to do what she did. So we approached that scene from one of your most basic acting things always, which is it's more interesting to play against. So if you take bile coming up in your throat, and for me, I made it about that paper. As soon as she got that paper, she felt bile rising in her throat. How long can you keep it down?
Hold it in,
and it makes you breathe differently, and it makes you swallow differently, and it makes you very intentional when you are trying desperately. And we've all been there where you're like, do not let me cry right now because I'll lose all my power. Don't let me barf. I don't want to scream. I don't think she likes giving up control. Mm-hmm. And so the push it down ended up making my body literally vibrate through it. And I'm never totally happy with my work, but I was happy with the response that fans felt like it was a tremendous amount of pain going on in that scene.
Again, sticking with, these are all season four. So episode eight, Kim helps Jimmy to get Huel off joining him in a con, of course. And then at the end, when we think she might tell him off for having made her do this, instead kisses him and says, let's do it again.
Right.
So now it's like past the point of no return, right?
Yeah. The scripts are page turners. I didn't see that coming, but they're just so smart on the show because it never feels like a stunt. It doesn't feel like, oh, you're making me do something you never expected just to make me do something you never expected. It's more like, oh, right, that's always been there. Oh, right.
and even you yourself didn't necessarily know it.
Exactly. But if you go backwards, you're like, okay, yeah, there
you
was
can
flex.
Work it back, yeah. Okay. Episode 9 of season 4, this one I think is this takes the cake. The rooftop scene, directed by Vince Gilligan and basically...
Written by Jen Hutchinson.
Mm-hmm. And Jimmy and Kim both basically lay out all of their grievances, basically say everything that's been pent up, and you wonder if this is a breaking point.
Right, yeah. They do such a great job on the show, the writers, of frequently, if not always, making arguments where you can see both sides as the audience. Mm-hmm. And Bob and I obviously had to go to a place, and if he was here right now, he would argue to the death that Jimmy is actually completely the only person who's right in that scene. And I felt the opposite, as we should.
that he's saying, you don't support me enough, and she's saying, I give up everything for it. Anytime you need me, I'm there.
It's the office. You are shitting on me by refusing to slum it to have an office with me. And she's saying, I do everything else. How could it possibly be about this office? But what I do understand and I do like, and it starts in the diner scene before that rooftop, right after the scam, is that I like it when they do let you see Kim is not a martyr nor a saint. And it isn't just about like he infected her and taints her. It is stuff that's in her. Yeah. There is a need for control and ambition and to be the crusader and the hero that is flawed in its obsessiveness. Mm-hmm. And when she's saying like we only use our powers for good, and he's like, how is that? How is anybody deciding which? So that con was good or this one's? And she shuts him down. We're not talking about it. And in the rooftop, her argument is a sound argument, except for the fact that if your partner tells you that every time you bring milk cartons home, it causes them intense pain, the conversation about why that's ridiculous is not the whole picture. And anybody who's in a relationship knows that, like, you still have to address the fact that they said it causes them pain, and can we talk about that and what is actually going on? And she refuses to. She refuses to acknowledge it because I don't think she wants to answer that question either.
And at the end of it, he feels that maybe for the first time she lets him see that, I don't know if loser is too strong a word, but I mean, Jimmy, you're always down.
Right. That was a hard line.
That's kind of like got to be shivving him. Yeah.
We played it a couple of different ways. And Vince is such a great, great director. In the end, he said, no, I think she means... Because I was wondering, like, is she saying this to hurt him, or does she believe it? Mm-hmm. Or is it something in between? What it is instead for me in that moment is it's just simply the truth. If you're going to tell me the excuse for your bad behavior is because you had a shitty day, then we have to do something about the fact that you seem to continue to have shitty days every single day. Otherwise, your behavior is going to stay the same. Right. And I think that's what she's saying in the moment is what you're blaming this on your whole life of being stepped on. You have to make some decisions about that because, yeah, you're right. You do keep getting stepped on. So what do you want to do about it?
Right.
Yeah.
Fourth of the four that I'm going to ask about season four is episode 10, the last time we saw Kim on screen, this whole sequence of Jimmy at his reinstatement appeal and making such a convincing plea, and then with Kim afterwards revealing that he was acting. And as she processes both sets of information, the contrast seems to sort of rock her to the core, which is the last thing that we see in the season as we now have to wait for season 5. So just playing that... There's a lot of ways you could have played the way she responds to this.
Yeah. Yeah. And she's mostly silent. which I love.
I went and rewatched it this morning just to be like really up on it. And even so, you're in whatever the room is where he's making his reinstatement plea. Mm-hmm. And again, you're not, as you say, you're not saying anything, but even like you're, I don't know if it's swallowing or gasping, but like your neck like bulges when he says, you start to believe what he's saying. And so therefore, if it has that effect on you when you believe it, you then have to have the counter, right, when you realize it was bullshit.
Yeah, yeah. It was a very complex series of scenes. Adam Bernstein directed that. Tom and Peter wrote it. And I felt like I needed to leave space when he's doing the reinstatement hearing to be surprised by... Obviously, she's surprised that he's changing the game plan. And at first, she's very worried about that because... She orchestrated the majority of how she was going to get him reinstated.
Talk about Chuck.
Yeah. Yep. And, you know, buying the library in Chuck's name and fake crying at the cemetery. Right. I think that Kim's constantly trying to justify and compartmentalize the scam she will be a part of. And they're a little Robin Hood complexy about doing the right thing. And in this case, I think she believes he absolutely does deserve to practice law. And therefore, the tiny notion of whether or not they think you're sincere is neither here nor there. And so the means to the end, it's a wash. But dangerous thinking, in my opinion. But so when he changes the plan, I think she's very worried. But then when she thinks he's being sincere, I left space for myself as an actor in that moment to let Kim be surprised by why she has an emotional reaction to that. And I think it has to do with how long she's been missing having a partner that was emotionally available and present. And as you said before, somebody that to talk to. And I think she wasn't aware how much she misses that kernel of Jimmy until she sees it. And just relief for your partner that like, oh my gosh, maybe you can heal now if you'll like let it go. And to then, to then shift to the hallway. And they did such, Adam staged it perfectly that Jimmy does not see me cry behind him. Nor is he facing me for the beginning of the scene once we're out in the hallway, because he does not see my reaction shift when he starts saying, like, did you see that idiot in there who shed a tear and all this? And again, the audience is the only confidant I have in that room. They know how crushing that would be, how embarrassing it is for your instincts and your emotions to be wrong. There's so many things going on there of, oh my God, who is this person? And then also to be the sucker. To be the person that you scammed me and you don't even, but he doesn't know it. So she's rendered speechless for a million reasons that it's like, well, how do I explain how you just hurt me? How do I even explain how you just hurt me?
And by the end of it, Jimmy is gone. That's Saul Goodman.
Yeah.
So that's, I guess, where we've left things.
Yeah. And they do that wonderful pullback on the camera that Marshall Adams did that leaves her alone on an island, which... It's more alone than she's even felt for the whole rest of the season. And to a lesser extent, I kept thinking about those times in our lives when someone that you care about deeply wants to join an activity or join a club that is without you. And you want to be happy for them. Like, they seem like they really found out what's, you know, going to make their life great. But you're thinking, I don't know. I go to that club?
Right.
Am I going to be a member in that club? Or, like, are you... Where are you going? Do I fit in that story?
Well, and so looking ahead here, I mean, it's not totally official, I guess, yet about how much more Better Call Saul we're going to have. I think there's been one suggestion from Giancarlo Esposito that we'll get the fifth and a sixth or whatever, but that there might be some symmetry in the number of episodes between Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. But one question that's always been here, we assume, because it leads into Breaking Bad, that we know where Jimmy ends up. We know where Mike ends up and a few others of these bad guys who come in and out.
Gus Fring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We don't know about Kim, if she even exists in the Breaking Bad universe. And so I guess my question is, as we look ahead to the, whether it's one or two more seasons of Better Call Saul, I mean, do you personally already know where Kim ends up?
No. I just read script 6 and I don't know what happens in 7.
Wow.
So I don't know. They don't do that.
Nobody's coming whispered.
They do not,
like,
no.
Yeah. And then again, along those lines, it really, I mean, it seems like there's only so many.
I can't even tell you if I'm in 6 or 7. I'm just
reading
them. I'm not allowed to.
Yeah. But I mean, okay. So, but in the longer term, in terms of as this eventually feeds into Breaking Bad, you're either dead or you're alive and with Jimmy, but we haven't seen you because we don't know much about Jimmy, now Saul's home life,
right.
Or you're not, you're alive and you're
or
not
I'm
with.
Alive and not with him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So in your own view, what would be the best and worst case scenario, knowing your character?
What's infinitely interesting is that all three of those could be considered a tragedy.
Yeah.
I've kind of given up on guessing or even hoping. The good thing is that the one guarantee is in Peter Gould and Vince Gilligan and our whole writing staff's hands. They haven't disappointed me for one second yet of making the perfect choices for Kim to just keep evolving and keep growing. And she is not, talk about, you know, going from point A to point B. Kim's not the same character as she was when we first met her, and what was there before that, and what's coming up that was always there versus what's now happening in real time and is new. Does she affect Jimmy, or does Jimmy affect her, or do they affect each other? Somebody asked me once too, like, would Jimmy become Saul and Kim end up wherever Kim's going to end up if they had never met? What is Beautiful Creatures, where it's the combination of the two of you, and what is independent paths that couldn't have been altered anyway?
Nobody can ever know in any way.
Right, you can't. Yeah. But I think that innate versus innate and destiny versus free will are questions they play with a lot on the show. And yeah, I'm sorry they don't have a specific answer other than I've become a little more at peace with, if you're going to die on a show, it might as well be this one because it's going to be spectacular.
Right.
If she's going to stay, that's so complex. And I can't possibly figure out how you would write that. But thank God that's not my job. And if she's going to go, if she's alive but she leaves, what is that about? And still, what will she become?
Like, you wonder if he destroys her or sets her free, basically. Because
right. Or does she destroy herself?
Or herself, yeah.
Or set herself free.
Right.
I don't know. Or does she destroy him?
Right. Well, we see that he's got his issues in Breaking Bad. So.
I mean, Saul Goodman is a man with some damage.
Yes. Last two. This has been quite an interesting year. I don't know chronologically when things were shot, but beyond Better Call Saul, we saw you as Michelle, who is the Amy of Hugh Laurie's presidential candidate, Tom James, on Veep, the last season of Veep, which is great as well.
Fantastic season.
Terrific. We saw you as a woman fending off men who have gone nuts in the aftermath of a meteor shower in the Not All Men episode of the Twilight Zone reboot on CBS All Access. And Jeanette, the trashy cousin of Patricia Arquette's character on Hulu's The Act, a limited series that is going over very well as well. So how did this all happen in 1 year? And any other?
These were all over the hiatus. Yes, I also did an independent film written and directed by Christopher Winterbauer called Worm, W-Y-R-M. That was the feature-length film based on his extremely well-received short from Sundance. And it's so beautiful and funny and strange and interesting and unique. And I loved that. And then I went to Cape Town, South Africa to film the sequel to Inside Man. I did Inside Man 2.
Oh, that's awesome. With who's the director?
It's still Spike Lee's property, but MJ Bassett directed it, and it is Universal 1440 for Netflix.
Okay.
Amil Amin and Roxanne McKee are the other two leads in it, and they're fantastic. Yeah, it was great.
Jeez,
it was great.
Still packing a lot of stuff in.
It was a lot of variety and genre and tone, too, which was fun.
Yes. All right, last question. Just sort of looking ahead, one thing that has got to be nice is that I feel like your performance on Better Call Saul has gotten more appreciation for this season than maybe, not that it wasn't appreciated for the earlier three, but like my sense is they've stepped up and recognized it more this season. And it's interesting because speaking of parallels with Breaking Bad, it wasn't until the fourth season of Breaking Bad that Anna Gunn really started to get not only an Emmy nomination, but was actually sort of getting that same kind of, we need to pay more attention.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so I guess I just wonder.
I thought she was brilliant from day one.
Yeah, day one. Yeah. But she took a lot of shit, I remember, from that character. And anyway, just this particular moment in time for where you are in the show and the career and all of it, big picture, any thoughts?
Of that kind of attention?
Well, not about the attention, so just like, that this is where this whole thing that we've been talking about for this conversation has led. How do you feel about this moment?
Really grateful. I mean, there's also, 400 shows on the air now?
Yeah.
So you could be doing the best work of your life and no one knows what channel it's on. You can get lost pretty easily. So I feel incredibly fortunate that Vince and Peter names and people wanting to follow whatever they make, and then the mothership Breaking Bad being one of the best shows of all time was our launch pad. There's no doubting the fortune that we gained from that because people bothered to watch. So we're not in a vacuum. And so I don't forget that. And I know that there's great work on that struggles to have eyeballs on it. So we're very lucky to have that. And then beyond that, I just feel, I guess, even more and more gratitude. Season 4 was challenging. It was really challenging in the way that I hoped the craft of acting was going to be when I very first started. It makes me dig deep, and it makes me have to really test myself and to get better. And then I get to work with people like Bob Odenkirk and Patrick Fabian and the whole rest of my cast. They're just generous and genuine. And yeah, I don't know what to express other than gratitude. When people start talking about like, oh, she deserves critical acclaim, she deserves awards, it's nice. I'd be lying if I didn't say that, like, it feels nice after doing this for 25 years. Yeah, it feels amazing, but it's also a dangerous thing to feel hopeful. Or to think like, oh, was I crap when I wasn't being noticed?
Yeah, there is all the, that it's all a wild card in a way.
But, you know, I mean, I'm being challenged to be better and better, make myself a better and better actor, and then I'm being given tools that are these scripts, so it kind of doesn't get better. And so if the result of that really is grabbing some people, and people are so responsive to my character, people want to talk about my character like she's a real human being all the time. Right. And that, I got to tell you, that's an amazing experience.
Great. Well, thank you for doing this. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much for tuning into Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast for free on iTunes or your podcast app, and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg, and you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/TheRace. Finally, be sure to check out the other podcasts that are part of the Hollywood Reporter's podcast network, all of which are excellent. Leslie Goldberg and Daniel Feinberg's TV's Top 5, Seth Abramovich and Chip Pope's It Happened in Hollywood, Carolyn Giardina's Behind the Screen, and Josh Wigler's Series Regular. On behalf of all of us at The Hollywood Reporter, thanks for tuning in.